Imagine sitting down to a plate of fresh, wild-caught fish. It looks, well, completely identical to the fish your parents or maybe your grandparents ate.
Right.
Same shape, same color, same preparation. But invisibly, on a literal molecular level, it has been hollowed out.
Yeah, it's wild to think about.
It has been stripped of the vital nutrients your brain, your bones, and your immune system desperately need to function.
Exactly.
And that is the invisible reality of our changing oceans. It is happening right now. I mean, we always picture climate change as these massive structural events, you know.
Oh, for sure. Flooded cities, melting glaciers.
Category 5 storms, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there is a silent crisis playing out directly on the dinner plates of millions of people, and it's about a catastrophic loss of hidden micronutrients.
It is a profound and, frankly, terrifying shift. We usually measure the health of the ocean by looking at whether habitats like coral reefs are surviving. But what we really need to look at is the biochemical reality. We are losing the fundamental building blocks of human health entirely because of how the ocean's physical chemistry is reacting to a warming planet.
Which is exactly what we are focusing on for today's deep dive.
Yeah.
We are exploring a fascinating and highly alarming 2024 study.
Yeah, a really crucial piece of research.
It was published in the journal Science of the Total Environment, led by researcher Paolo Cappa, alongside a massive global team of scientists.
Right.
Our mission today is to figure out exactly how climate change is altering wild capture fisheries across Southeast Asia, the Pacific Islands, and Oceania.
And more importantly, what those changes mean for the actual nutritional survival of the populations living there.
Exactly.
To fully grasp the magnitude of the data in this study, we first have to appreciate what the ocean is currently doing for us. I mean, it is the ultimate climate buffer.
The ultimate sponge, basically.
Right. Every single year, the ocean absorbs roughly 90% of the excess heat generated by human activities.
90%? That is wow.
Yeah, 90. And on top of that, it absorbs about 26% of our carbon dioxide emissions.
Unbelievable.
If the ocean wasn't doing this heavy lifting, the atmospheric warming you and I experience would be unimaginably worse.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if the ocean is acting like a giant global sponge for heat and carbon, well, that sponge is going to change chemically.
Exactly.
What exactly is happening to the water itself, and how does that trigger this nutritional crisis?
So the water is undergoing three major physical transformations. Huh. First, it's getting significantly warmer.
Why?
Second, absorbing all that carbon dioxide makes the water more acidic. And third, physics dictates that warm water simply cannot hold as much dissolved gas as cold water.
Oh, I see.
So as the ocean heats up, it literally holds less oxygen. The ocean is essentially becoming hotter, more acidic, and less breathable.
Less breathable. Wow. How does marine life actually respond to that? I mean, they can't just migrate to a forest. They are stuck in that water.
Right. They are entirely dependent on their specific environmental conditions. Marine species have evolved to thrive in very distinct temperature and oxygen ranges.
Sure.
When the water gets too hot and holds less oxygen, they are forced to move. Generally, we are seeing a massive reorganization of marine life.
Like geographically?
Yeah. Fish are migrating poleward, so moving north and south toward the colder waters near the poles.
Okay.
And they are also moving deeper into the ocean column to escape those warming surface temperatures.
So they are literally fleeing just to find breathable, cool water.
Exactly.
But wait, earlier you mentioned that the fish on our plates might look the same, but the biology is changing. Are the fish themselves actually transforming?
Yes, they are. And this is where the biology gets incredible and, well, a bit scary. Marine species are actively shrinking in average body size.
Shrinking? Like physically getting smaller? Why would warmer water make a fish smaller?
What's fascinating here is the biological mechanism behind it. It comes down to something called the gill oxygen limitation theory.
Okay. Gill oxygen limitation theory. Walk me through that.
So when water warms up, a fish's metabolism speeds up. It's like an engine running hotter, you know? It requires a lot more oxygen to function.
Right. But remember, we just established that warmer water holds less oxygen.
Precisely. And here is the kicker. A fish's body grows in three dimensions. It gains volume.
Right, it gets fatter and longer.
Exactly. But its gills, which actually extract the oxygen, they only grow in two dimensions as surface area.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Eventually, as the fish tries to grow, its massive 3D body demands more oxygen than its 2D gills can physically pull from the oxygen-depleted water.
So the body outpaces the lungs, essentially.
Exactly. The fish literally cannot oxygenate a larger body mass, so its growth stops early. It suffocates out of growing larger.
That is mind-blowing. So if we put this into human terms, imagine your local grocery store slowly relocating miles away to the suburbs, making it harder and harder to reach. And because the factory supplying the store can't get enough raw materials, all the packages on the shelves are shrinking.
That's a great analogy.
You have to travel further, spend more energy, just to bring back a fraction of the food.
Yeah.
But is this happening to everything? I mean, a tuna is very different from a small reef fish.
It is affecting virtually all of it, just through different mechanisms. For local, small-scale coastal fisheries, the kind that millions of people in Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands rely on daily, the damage is structural.
What do you mean by structural?
Well, the warmer acidic water causes coral bleaching and reef erosion. The fish that rely on the reef for shelter and plankton, they lose their habitat.
I see.
And when they lose that habitat, those populations collapse.
So the grocery store building itself is collapsing in that scenario.
Exactly. But then look at the large pelagic fish, you know, the open ocean wanderers like tuna.
Right.
These are massive economic drivers. They don't rely on reefs, but they do rely on temperature envelopes.
Okay.
As those envelopes shift poleward and deeper, the tuna migrate with them. They're moving completely out of the historical fishing grounds. From the shallow reefs to the deep open sea, the entire biological map is being redrawn.
Okay, so if the fish are shrinking and the populations are fleeing or dying off, the sheer tonnage of food coming out of the ocean has to be plummeting.
It is.
Do these researchers actually know how much food is going to disappear? Like, how do you even predict a wild animal's movement 80 years from now?
It is incredibly complex, but the researchers use something called a dynamic bioclimate envelope model.
Okay. What does that actually mean in plain English?
Think of it as mapping a species' perfect comfort zone. The computer model takes a specific fish, maps out the exact temperature, oxygen levels, and salinity it needs to survive.
Right.
And then it looks at global climate projections to see where that specific comfort zone will actually exist in the future. Will it move hundreds of miles away? Will it disappear entirely?
And then they use that map to calculate how many fish will be left to catch.
Yes. They project what they call the maximum catch potential.
Maximum catch potential.
Right. This is a proxy for the maximum sustainable yield. Basically, the absolute maximum amount of fish you can pull out of a specific country's waters without the population totally collapsing.
Okay, I follow.
They ran these models for 25 different countries across two futures, a best-case scenario where humanity aggressively cuts emissions, and a worst-case scenario where we just keep burning fossil fuels at high rates.
Here's where it gets really interesting, and honestly, pretty devastating.
Yeah, it's grim.
Let's look at the actual magnitude of what these models predict. Because we aren't talking about losing a fraction of a percent here.
No, we are talking about ecosystem-level collapse. Let's look at Oceania, which includes places like Australia and New Zealand.
Okay.
By the end of the century, even under the absolute best-case scenario where we do everything right globally, they are projecting a loss of over half their catch potential.
Half.
More than 50%. Just gone.
And that is the region that fares the best in this study, right?
Right. Now look at Southeast Asia. The study projects a drop of over 65% with strong climate mitigation.
65%.
And under high emissions, we're looking at an 86% plunge.
That's just nuts.
And the Pacific Islands are hit the hardest. Under a high emission scenario, by the year 2100, the catch potential in the Pacific Islands plummets by up to 92%.
9 out of every 10 fish. Just yeah. Gone.
I just want you to pause and really internalize that for a second. Imagine losing up to 90% of the natural yield of a primary food source in the span of a single human lifetime.
It's hard to wrap your head around.
If a country lost 90% of its wheat or its rice, I mean, it would be an apocalyptic global emergency.
It is a staggering loss of volume.
Mm-hmm.
But the true brilliance of this study is that the researchers didn't stop at just measuring raw tonnage.
Right.
Losing calories is terrible, but the authors emphasize that fish are not just calories. When the volume of fish plummets, you are losing highly specific biochemical components. It's not just about filling stomachs. It's about what those missing fish were supposed to do for the human body.
Exactly. The researchers cross-referenced the shrinking fish populations with an aquatic food composition database.
Okay.
They tracked 7 crucial micronutrients: calcium, omega-3 fatty acids, iodine, iron, vitamin A, vitamin B12, and zinc.
Let's ground that for a second. We aren't just talking about taking a daily multivitamin. Omega-3s are critical for brain development in children.
Right.
And preventing cognitive decline in adults. Zinc is essential for your immune system. Calcium for bone density. Iron to prevent anemia.
These are the exact nutrients that determine whether a human being thrives or simply survives.
Right.
The researchers took those 7 nutrients and measured them against the recommended nutrient intake. You know, the baseline requirements for human health, specifically for the populations in these regions.
So they were essentially asking, when the catches drop this drastically, will the ocean still provide enough vitamins and minerals to keep these populations healthy?
Exactly. And the data shows a pretty grim reality. Even under the best case climate scenario, the domestic fisheries of Oceania and the Pacific Islands will fail to provide enough of most of these 7 micronutrients to meet their population's needs.
Wow.
Southeast Asia is already failing to meet these nutritional baselines right now.
Today.
And as the catches drop by up to 86%, that deficit is going to become an absolute chasm.
Wait, hold on. I'm looking at the data from the source, and I see a really bizarre paradox here.
Yeah, you probably spotted the iodine number.
Exactly. It says that despite these massive drops, 2 specific nutrients, iodine and vitamin B12, they're projected to remain in a surplus across all 3 regions.
Right.
So technically, the ocean will still provide enough of them. But I read a few paragraphs down that populations in countries like Vanuatu and French Polynesia suffer from severe documented iodine deficiencies.
Yes.
How is that possible? If there is a surplus of iodine in the nets, why are the actual people deficient?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you uncover the critical blind spot in looking only at biology. You have to look at global trade.
Trade.
Yeah. Just because a nutrient-dense fish is caught in a country's waters doesn't mean it ever reaches a local dinner plate.
Because of the export market.
Exactly. Think about the large pelagic species caught in the Pacific. Prime tuna.
Right.
It is loaded with nutrients, but it is also highly valuable in Tokyo or Los Angeles or London. So the premium fish is exported to wealthier nations for cash.
It's like a local farming community harvesting premium organic avocados.
Yeah, perfect example.
Realizing they can sell them to the city for an absolute fortune and then having to use that cash to buy instant noodles to feed their own families.
That is exactly what happens. The premium nutrients leave the country and the void is filled by imported, highly processed foods.
Junk food, basically.
Right. Foods that are high in fat, salt, and sugar, but completely devoid of essential micronutrients. This creates what public health experts call the double burden of malnutrition.
Double burden.
Yeah. A population might have enough calories to avoid starvation, but because they traded their nutrient-dense seafood for processed imports, they are profoundly malnourished.
Which means the actual nutritional crisis on the ground is going to be significantly worse than even these models project.
Because the models assume the fish actually stays in the country.
Wow. Okay, so the ocean is getting too hot, the fish are shrinking and fleeing, our catch yields are plummeting, and the nutrients we actually do catch are being exported.
Yeah, it's a perfect storm.
This is a massive, multifaceted crisis. How do we actually navigate this? I mean, first thing that comes to mind is farming. If the wild ocean is failing, can't we just build massive aquaculture farms and breed the fish we need?
It seems like the logical next step, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the study lays out a few massive limitations to aquaculture. First, if you are doing mariculture, you know, farming fish in pens in the open ocean, those fish are trapped in the exact same warming, acidic, deoxygenated water as the wild fish. They're entirely exposed to the same climate hazards.
Right. The water inside the pen is just as hot as the water outside.
Exactly. But the second limitation is much deeper, and it has to do with fed aquaculture. To farm certain types of fish, you have to feed them.
Sure.
And what is the primary ingredient in commercial fish feed?
Fish meal, which I'm guessing comes from the wild ocean.
It does. Historically, a massive percentage of the global wild catch has been scooped up, ground into pellets, and fed to farmed fish.
Oh, wow.
And we aren't just talking about scraps. We are catching perfectly good, prime, nutrient-dense wild species, fish that humans could easily eat, and grinding them up.
So we are essentially laundering our ocean's nutrients. We pull wild calories out of the sea, burn a bunch of energy, turning them into pellets, feed them to farmed fish, and lose a massive amount of the original nutritional value in the translation.
We are losing an incredible amount of direct human nutrition to feed a commercial industry.
That is crazy.
The researchers point out that if we were highly selective and redirected those food-grade wild fish away from fish meal and directly onto human plates, we could immediately offset some of these nutritional deficits.
Right, cut out the middleman.
Exactly. Aquaculture has a role to play, but right now it often cannibalizes the very wild stocks we are trying to protect.
So if we can't just farm our way out of this, what are the actual solutions? What does the study recommend we actually do on a policy level to survive this?
Well, the overarching theme is that we need to build intense local resilience to buy ourselves time while the world attempts to lower carbon emissions.
Okay, how do we do that?
One of the primary recommendations is the aggressive expansion of no-take marine protected areas, or MPAs.
MPAs. Mm-hmm. So zones in the ocean where absolutely no commercial fishing is allowed.
Right.
But wait, if we're already losing up to 90% of our catch, how does closing off even more of the ocean help feed people?
Because of the spillover effect. Think of an MPA like a highly secured bank vault for marine biology. By leaving that specific reef or coastal zone entirely alone, the ecosystem has the breathing room to build resilience against climate stress. The fish grow to full size, they breed prolifically, and eventually that population overflows the boundaries of the protected area.
I get it. The interest spills out into the public accounts.
Exactly. The areas adjacent to the MPAs end up seeing significantly higher, more stable catch yields.
That makes total sense.
The second major policy recommendation is ending harmful industrial fisheries subsidies.
Subsidies where governments are basically paying giant industrial fleets to overfish. Right. The study noted this is a particularly massive problem in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, it makes absolutely no economic or ecological sense. Governments are financially incentivizing the destruction of the natural resource their populations rely on for survival.
That's wild.
Those funds need to be redirected into sustainable, local, small-scale fishery management.
It sounds incredibly daunting to get entire countries to change their economic models.
Yeah.
But there is a bright spot in the source material that genuinely gave me hope. The Nauru Agreement.
Oh, yes. The Nauru Agreement is one of the most brilliant examples of regional cooperation on the planet.
Tell me about it.
Pacific Island nations have massive stretches of ocean. I mean, their exclusive economic zones are huge. But historically, they lacked the navies or infrastructure to patrol them.
Right.
So massive distant water fishing fleets from global superpowers would just come in, vacuum up the prime tuna, and leave.
So the islands had the resource, but no power to protect it.
Right. So several Pacific Island nations banded together under the Nauru Agreement. Instead of negotiating with these global superpowers individually, they act as a unified bloc to collectively manage their shared tuna fisheries.
Strength in numbers.
Exactly. By setting shared rules and quotas, they suddenly had immense leverage. They significantly increased their economic returns and forced the distant water fleets to comply with sustainable practices.
This raises an important question, though, regarding what we actually value moving forward. The Nauru Agreement shows that we can manage the ocean differently if we choose to.
Yeah, it really does.
The researchers are essentially putting a choice in front of global policymakers. Are we managing our oceans for maximum economic yield, you know, to make the most cash on the export market? Or do we need to start managing them for maximum nutrient yield to ensure human biological survival?
That is the paradigm shift. Highly developed nations like Australia and New Zealand have diverse agricultural sectors.
Right. They have options.
They can afford to treat fish as a financial commodity because if the fish disappear, they can get their vitamins from fortified foods or diverse crops.
But for the Pacific Islands and Southeast Asia, fisheries are the public health infrastructure.
Exactly. Developing domestic blue food policies, you know, policies that explicitly prioritize keeping nutrient-dense seafood within the local populations rather than exporting it, that is an absolute necessity.
So what does this all mean? Let's bring all these threads together for you. Climate change is physically altering the chemistry of the ocean.
Right.
That changing chemistry is forcing marine life to flee and physically stunting the growth of the fish that remain. Because of this, our models project devastating declines in the sheer volume of food we can pull from the sea, up to 90% in the hardest hit areas.
It's staggering.
And this isn't just a loss of calories. It is the theft of essential micronutrients like omega-3s, calcium, and zinc from the diets of millions across Southeast Asia and the Pacific.
Completely.
And because of the global export market, the nutrient-dense fish that are caught are often shipped overseas, leaving local populations to rely on imported processed junk.
Yeah, the double burden.
To survive, we need to stop feeding prime wild fish to farmed fish, we need to end subsidies that pay for overfishing, and we need regional cooperation to protect the marine vaults we have left.
Well said. And that leaves us with a final thought to consider, something deeper than just the data. For thousands of years, human communities along the coasts have drawn their physical strength, their brain development, and their cultural identity directly from the complex biology of the wild ocean. We evolved in tandem with what the sea provided. But as climate change literally boils those essential micronutrients out of the water, we're being forced to look elsewhere.
Yeah.
If we can no longer rely on wild, natural ecosystems to build human health, we are staring down a future where our local food cultures are entirely replaced by globally engineered, bio-fortified alternatives.
Wow. Pills, supplements, and lab-designed calories.
Exactly. We aren't just losing the fish in our nets. We are severing the ancient, direct biological link between the vitality of the wild planet and the health of the human body. What happens to our understanding of ourselves and our relationship with nature when the ocean can no longer sustain us?